It's great for me to see that so many people have joined this session. Now, let's do a quick show of hand. Who of you is a desktop developer who would say, well, I create Windows applications? That's perfect. Who is a web developer mainly? Okay, that's pretty good. So the session might be interesting for you as well. Who is an iPhone developer? Okay, this session doesn't really work for you. Now, in the next 75 minutes, I'd like to talk about Silverlight, but not in the way as Silverlight is viewed most of the time as somehow Microsoft's Flash competitor, but to view Silverlight as a business developer or as a desktop developer might see Silverlight and to show points and places inside of Silverlight which illustrate how this technology can be used for business applications. As always in my sessions, you can, of course, come up to me afterwards for any questions. My email address is ingo.rammer@thinktecture.com for any questions which might come up later. And you'll be able to download the demos and the slide deck at thinktecture.com. There's a link to conferences, and I'll post all these materials later this week. Now, you're in the right session if you develop desktop or line of business applications. Or maybe if you create an intranet applications, but somehow want to move this towards the desktop. We have clients who use Silverlight and some of the features of Silverlight 4 just, for example, to ease their printing because they want to have picture-perfect or page-perfect printing from a web application. These are things which you could do with Silverlight as a business developer. Or, of course, if you are a Silverlight developer today, if you've been to Mike's session yesterday and Mike sent you to this session to learn something about RIA services, because a large part of this session will be about RIA services. Now, today when we talk with clients about Silverlight, then a lot of clients approach this topic as if it was a Flash competitor. That's somehow the main myth today. Well, in reality, most of Flash today is used to stream videos, Vimeo, YouTube, etc. And of course, you have got a lot of games, etc. What you don't see in Flash very often is that it's used as a basic for business applications. It's really more entertainment-driven. Now, Silverlight offers all these entertainment-driven features, but gives you a very nice platform for business applications, mainly because it uses the tools, the technologies, the patterns, the languages, which you already know today when you create Windows applications. It follows, in a large part, it follows the same patterns. If you look at Silverlight 4, and if you create WPF applications today, then you know that, for example, there is something like a command pattern, and Silverlight 4 brings you the same pattern. It also gives you additional support for the simplified development of client-server applications, or, well, rather, three-tier applications by using RIA services. RIA services encapsulates a lot of the client-server, a lot of the web service logic behind the scenes. And today, it gives you a unified platform between PC and Mac, and in the future, this will be extended towards Windows Phone 7 series development, which also runs on Silverlight. And you'll be able to transport some of the knowledge you have towards this future platform as well. RIA services might be something which won't work with Phone 7 at the beginning. They have no definitive answers on this yet, but Silverlight as such will work on this platform. Okay, what am I going to cover? Well, mainly I'm going to cover the RIA services. You'll see how RIA services works, what it does, what the use case is for RIA services, how to develop and how to extend it. I'll talk a bit about the model view model concept. Who knows model view model? Okay, that's pretty good. That's about half of you in the room. Now, MVVM is a pattern which you somehow need to know in whatever form to at least be able to discuss it. I'm not making a definitive answer if this is good or bad or if it's the right choice for your application, but you should at least know it. And it's really just a very quick topic because I want to be able to get you started to develop Silverlight business applications. Okay, so what's RIA services? RIA services is an architecture and an implementation for distributed applications. In theory, it's client agnostic. There are ideas to extend this to provide clients for WPF, which allow you the same kind of interaction as you'll have today in Silverlight. Today, the main client will be Silverlight 4. The server side is implemented purely in WCF. With a very interesting twist, it doesn't look like WCF, unless you want it to look like WCF. But if you don't care about the service side, if you say, I only care about data, then you never have to write a service. Everything is done behind the scenes. If you say, I care about services, then you have the full power of the WCF. Even if you don't care about services, you still get the configuration, the hosting options from inside WCF. Okay, how does RIA look like? Well, let me just start a very quick application. What I'm going to do today is I'm going to build on one sample application. I'll start totally from scratch and walk you through these individual steps to get a RIA application working. I will copy and paste parts of the project from a fully existing and running demo just so that we can focus on the RIA aspects and not so much on the SAML UI design aspects, because I think SAML UI design, as it is in WPF or Silverlight, is something which is pretty well known today. Okay, so let me just start a new project. I'll start a project of type Silverlight, and it's a Silverlight business application, which is interesting because it sounds as if you would not be allowed to create business apps with just a Silverlight application. Actually, Silverlight business app means that this is an application running on the RIA infrastructure. Okay, I'll just create this in CDEV net 4.0, and let's just call it business app 1. What Visual Studio does behind the scenes now is it creates a multi-tiered project structure. It creates client and server-side projects for me. On the server side, in theory, again, there's always this in theory aspect. In theory means that there is an extension point which allows you to do this, but by default, only one of these extensions is implemented. So by default, we are looking at a link-based server side. Most of these will be used with entity framework. So one of the first things you'll do in a RIA application is to bring your EDMX, your entity model, into the system. RIA is by default, if you don't extend it, if you don't change the default behavior, is very much data-driven. So your EDMX, your entity model, defines a lot of things how RIA thinks about the world. But you're going to see this in just a few moments. Okay. What we get here is we get two different applications. You get a client application and a web application. The web application also acts as the host for the Silverlight demo page and acts as the host for your services and for all the behind-the-scenes logic. It creates this project with a number of default directories. There's one for models, one for resources, which would be static information, and one for the services. So what I'll do is I'll just add my EDMX model, my entity framework model, as the default model here. And I'll just add a new item of type data, and this will be an ADO.NET entity data model. And now, I don't know how long you've been around in the Microsoft space. I've been around for quite a while, and I learned Microsoft technologies with the Northwind database. Who knows the Northwind database? Ah, that's a pretty good sign. Do you know how old Northwind is? Well, frankly, I don't know, but I can tell you that there is no email field in the customer record. Can you imagine this? There was a time before email, and Northwind is from that time. Now, the reason I'm using Northwind is not because it's such a nicely modeled database. It's really just because so many of you already know this database, and we don't need to talk too much about the database as such. So let's just call this Northwind model EDMX and import Northwind from the database. I'll really just click next, 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 just so that we can get some kind of model into our system. Okay, and I'll import all the tables. Okay, we'll just import this. I compile the application, and let's compile this. And really, that's just a regular Northwind. So for those of you who don't know it, it's a product ordering inventory kind of system, a very, very simplified system. You have customers, products, customers have orders. Orders consist of order items pointing towards a product, etc. So it's very, very simple. Okay. So this would be the model. And the next thing I do is I'll add the service. I just need to find it. This should be in, let me just check where they moved this one. Now that's interesting. Let me just check if I compiled this correctly. I'm in the right project. Yes, I am. And what I want to do is I want to add a domain service. So let's just try this again. Add new item. There should be a domain service here. There was earlier today. Let me just check this. Does anyone see it? If you see it, just... I search. That's a very good point. It's a domain service class. I still don't know where this is coming from, but at least it's there. And now you got me. I never used search feature. Is this new in 2010? Ah, here you go. That's pretty cool. You know, the thing is, I've used RIA services for quite a while, and during the beta, they changed a few things, and I just use this as a made-up excuse now, of course. I think they might have moved the domain service. Okay, so let's call this northwinddomainservice.cs. This starts a very interesting wizard. This wizard is that's a one-time thing. So the code which is created by this wizard is something which is meant as a starting point for your code. This wizard does not generate code which will be regenerated all the time. It's really a starting point. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to enable client access for some entities. I want to expose an OData endpoint. I'm not going to talk about OData today, but I think there was just two sessions earlier. There was a session on OData, and this just means that you can expose all the RIA data as a regular OData data as well. And I'll check all the entities and enable them for reading. By checking this one, you get read-only access. By checking this one, you get editing access. Down here, you can create associate classes for metadata. I'm going to talk about this in just a few minutes. What RIA Services does underneath the scenes is it uses the data annotation framework, which is also used by ASP.NET Dynamic Data or by ASP.NET MVC to provide additional annotation about the data you're using in your application. So that's not something which is purely based on RIA, but if you define, let's say, validation in this model, then this validation will be shared between RIA, ASP.NET, Dynamic Data, and MVC as well. And I'll just create this. That's, again, this metadata here is just a starting point. Okay, let's create this. The service we are getting is just a new class which derives from link to entities domain service. It's really just boilerplate code to get you started. You can see this, there are a number of to-dos here. To-do, add application logic if you want to, etc. What you'll find in this model are things like default queries for all the entities. You'll find get queries, insert and update queries, and of course delete queries, or delete methods in this case, for all your entities. So that's your basic CRUD infrastructure, this create, read, update, delete infrastructure to get you started in your project. Okay. Now, as soon as you compile this, you will be able to use these entities on the client side. So let me just start the application first, just so that you can see how the empty application looks like. And really, that's nothing special. You'll just get a default Silverlight application, which doesn't look very spectacular. And you'll have some basic navigation, some basic design. Really, it's just to get you started. And it's really just also to illustrate some ideas. So up here, you'll have navigation. You'll have a regular navigation application in terms of Silverlight. And you can then implement these different views. Now, what's happening is it uses client-side URL routing. So you have a URL slash home or a URL slash about, for example. And these URLs will be mapped to different pages in your navigation application, for those of you who don't know Silverlight navigation. And the interesting thing here is you have URIs which you can copy and paste and email to somebody. And if your coworker clicks on this URI, he or she can end up on the same page you have been at. If you extend this to master detail records, for example, you could imagine having a record identified or a page identified as customer, and ID is some kind of ID. And whenever you click through your application, a link will be generated. You can email this link. You also have backward forward capabilities, etc. That's just something you get out of the box right from the start. Okay, but what we want to do now is we want to somehow display customer data and allow the user to interact with this customer data. To do this, I go to the client-side project. In the client-side project, let's just look at the project right from the start. What you'll get is you get a few parts which contain client-side models. You'll get the views, which is what we are looking, what we'll be looking at right now to create a customer view. And you're looking mainly at controls, which contains individual controls which you want to share between your applications. Okay. Also, if you use the application, if you use Rhea for the first time, you'll see that there are some default views. Especially there is login, or there are some login components. I'm not going to use them, but just for completeness sake, Rhea supports form-based authentication. And if you use this login, then you'll have registration and authentication forms built in. I usually don't use them because we are basing most applications on some other kind of existing authentication scheme, but just for completeness. Okay, what I want to do now is I want to implement a view for customers. So I'll just take the home view and create a copy of the home view to get this started. And, oops, it's still running. Copy this. And actually, I'll take the content from somewhere else, because really the content here is not what this is about. I'll just call this customers, because I want to display customers there. And I'll copy this from C, dev. There should be a business application one, and there should be a view. Oh, it's pages here. And there should be a view customers. And I'll just copy this without copying the code. I don't care about the code too much right now. I just want to display these customers. And I need to change a few things. That's something I'll introduce later on when I introduce the view model. So I'll just comment this out. And I need to add a reference, oops, to this one, which should be, I think I deleted too much. Let me just go back to my code. This should be in here. Actually, there should be a namespace my somewhere. Yep, that's the one. Okay. Which is not referenced. And I just add this one. System Windows controls.data. Okay, now let's compile this one. And yep, that's true. A comment inside of a comment is not the best idea. Let's just close this comment. Okay, so here we just have the regular code. I'll just clean up the code here. And we don't need to change the title. We don't need to change this one. Okay, just by default, this gives us a starting point view. I need to add one more control later on, which actually displays a selected customer. But just so that we can get started, this should not happen. Oh, I changed it on the wrong page. Let's just swap these two and move the home back to the home. Okay, so that's home, that's customers, and okay, and I'm using a Silverlight library here, which I've created before, which I'll also just copy over. The reason I'm doing this here is, and the reason I'm walking you through this, is so that you can see what I'm doing. I've seen presentations on Silverlight Rhea which did not do this. So the problem is then they left out a few critical parts, but I really want you to see what's happening behind the scenes when you create an application. So I'll create one library, or I have created one library, which I'll copy over into this project. And in this library, I've defined just two classes. And both of them are relevant for the view model interaction. And I'll talk about these later. It's just that I'm referencing them right now. And I'll add a reference to this library. Add reference, and we'll just take this one. Okay, this is just, these are just helpers. They define a command which is taken from a framework called Silverlight FX. It's an extensibility framework or extension to Silverlight, which has been created by a person inside of Microsoft. So if you create Silverlight applications today, that's something you might want to check out, silverlight.fx by Mikhail. And I can't remember his last name. But if you just Google SilverlightFX, you can download this. It's a source code-based project. And I'm borrowing one file from this, which is a generic command. And if you develop Silverlight, that's something which you'll definitely use or which could be interesting. OK, so that's one thing. That's our UI. And if I've done it right now, if I didn't change the wrong one, yeah, OK, we have still incorrect layout in here. But that's fine. We can live with this. What I want to do is, if you enter a query, I want to load these customers. They should be displayed in a list, and they should somehow be visible. Okay, so let's just start this. And okay, that's the one I actually wanted to use later on. So I've just jumped a bit because that's the one which is already based on the view model. So what we'll do is we'll add the one which is not based on the view model, because I want to start you slowly. I want to start you in a way you would start as a business developer. Okay. And we'll take another view, which would be here. And this is the simple customer. And I'll just drag drop this and edit. Okay. Simple customer needs to build. And for this, we need an editor, which is a control which edits a single customer, and which would be this editor. And then added to controls. Okay, I'm going to talk about the contents of these things in just a second. Yep, and we don't need pages, we need views. And let's see, build succeeded. Okay, so what have I done? We've got a customer edit screen now, which looks like this. Rhea doesn't help you by default with the UI generation. You create your UI in the way you'd create any WPF or Silverlight UI just by using bidirectional data binding for all these fields. That's very simple. I'm just having one small control which I use to edit a single client, a single customer. That's my customer editor. On the page, which is more relevant for Rhea, I'm using this customer editor control here. I still have my incorrectly layouted title. And there are a few buttons here ready-made for showing them to you. Okay. Now, if I run the application, just to make sure everything works, and then I'll walk you through the code which I've created here. And that's very, it's really simple code, and let's just check that my system works the way I want it to work. Okay, Silverlight is running. I need to add navigation links, of course, because I've created a page, and I need to add it somehow to my navigation, and you do this on the main page in your project. On the website project, there will be a main page, SAML, and on the main page, you can change the navigation. Actually, you can change everything about the main page, and what I'll do is I'll just add a few more items to this. So, for example, I'll add a navigation URL to simple customers. I'll add one for later, to customers, and I'll add another one also for later to products. Simple customers and products. These are really just navigation links, these links which I've shown you before. And by default, it takes the names of these links out of resource files. For now, I'll just rename them to products and customers. And at the beginning, I'll do the simple customers. Simple doesn't necessarily mean that this is easier to implement. It just means that architecturally it's simpler because it doesn't use a view model. So you can look at it, and it looks not really nice because you will see that there's a lot of code directly inside the button click handler, etc. So that's usually not what you want to end up with. Okay. And after saving this one, we should get, oh, that's content, simple customer, customers, and product. Okay. Okay, let's start this again. Now, the system doesn't complain that we have links which point nowhere as of now. And by default, it will use the URI/customers to look up a page or a view inside of the view directory. So I get my simple customers. And what I want to do is I want to implement loading so that I can either specify a query or not, and it will load my data inside of the application. I could also query, and I could load more if I want to if I will implement paging later on. Okay. So that's just that you can see this. Well, there's one more thing. If I click on it, I get details which I can then save back to my database. So very simple to what a lot of business applications do, at least from a conceptual point of view. You just query data, display it, allow the user to change it. Okay, in terms of RIA, what does this mean? Behind the scenes, when we did what we just did, a context, a client-side context has been created. That's definitely interesting for those of you who are using WCF, for example, or using the OData access, etc. Because that's different from all these other things. I have not set any client-server references. I didn't do an ad service reference or an ad web reference. This happened behind the scenes. So what happened is that just by telling the system that this is a RIA project, it will automatically create a few client-side libraries or a few client-side classes based on the server-side information without explicitly managing URIs, etc. So I have a Northwind domain context because I have a Northwind domain service on the server side. And when I load the page, I just instantiate this context. This context is something which you can imagine similar to what an ADO.NET Entity Framework context is on the server side, insofar as it does the change tracking for you. So that's one of the main features of RIA. RIA supports full client-server change tracking, but it still relies on purely stateless, in terms of in-memory state, services. So there is no in-memory state on the server. It's really just that the client does the change tracking, does the delta tracking, and sends a delta during update back to the server. Okay. To load information, what you'll do by default is the following. You can go to your context, and all these queries which we've defined before can be accessed. So you get one of those queries using getCustomerQuery, and this is just an entity query of type customer. So you can use link to drive these queries. Again, for those of you who are doing WCF today, this might come as a surprise, because that's the second feature of RIA. It transports link queries between client and server. It serializes these link queries and sends them over to the server. Of course, your client cannot specify just any query they want, but quite the contrary is true. On the server side, you can change their query. You can extend things in their query. But let's say by default, if we have a query text, we'll add this as a where condition. Otherwise, we'll just add an order by statement here. I then clear the context. I clear the clients or the customer records which have already been downloaded to the client and invoke the load method. Load, and again, this is Silverlight. Load is asynchronous. For those of you who are developing WPF applications today or even ASP.NET applications today, but who haven't looked at Silverlight, that's one of the main differences between Silverlight and any other platform. Silverlight forces you to make every single resource access asynchronous. You cannot do a synchronous invocation of a web service. Only async is possible. This is done behind the scenes if you use RIA, because on the next line, I just set the item source of my data grid and tell it to take its items from customers. When I set this line of code, when this code is executed, the customers list will be empty. But we are binding our data grid, and when the data comes back from the server asynchronously later on, the list will be populated and it will synchronize itself with the grid. That's why we can display a grid like this. Okay. And, well, I then implemented a selection changed event. These are all things which you would not necessarily do like this in a real Silverlight application. It's really just to get started so that you can see the programming model. In this case, I just take the selected item from the grid, and I go to my editor control on the right side, and I'm assigning this as the new data context. And when the user clicks save, I'll perform a submit changes, and I perform the save operation. And what you see here is the asynchronous interaction in Silverlight now in a code-based view. You cannot simply just say context submit changes. Oops, let's switch to the keyword. Context submit changes. Well, you could, but if you'd execute this line of code, it will not do the same thing you'd expect this to do in the WPF or ASP.NET world. This is a non-blocking call. The call will complete immediately, even if the data has not been transferred or even if there's an error behind the scenes. Well, the error will bubble up somewhere, but not at this point. Instead, what you'll have to do is you'll have to pass a callback. This can now be a Lambda function or it can be an explicit callback, and the callback will be executed after your operation has been completed. And inside of this callback, you now have to check whether or not an error has happened. Because given that it's asynchronous, the system can't just throw an exception back to you. Instead, the callback will be invoked, and inside the callback, you check, did it complete or not? If it has an error, you have to mark this error as handled. Otherwise, this exception will bubble up towards the user. If you let it bubble up, and if there is no global exception handler, your application will exit. By default, as of the current version of RIA services, there is a default handler which will just pop up a message box and tell the user that something went wrong. Just like in Windows Forms, there used to be this message box whenever something went wrong. Okay, otherwise you just want to show an error, you can use error window create new, which is default in RIA. If there was no error, I'll just tell the user that everything went okay. Now, if you want to implement paging, for example, you could do this in a number of different ways. So one of those ways would be that you start here and say, well, and by the way, I want to take 5 and skip whatever. Just regular link-based paging. This would work. Actually, we could totally run this, but what I want to do is I want to show you a second or another feature of RIA services. And this is, you can change the way server-side services work. So let me go to the server, back to the generated service, back to our domain service. And here you have a query attribute on top of a query. And let me just look for the get customers query so that we are working with the correct query. Is default is true means that this is the default query whenever the system wants to work with customers. We don't need this right now, but you might later see how this is used, and especially when you have to remove it. And one of the properties is result limits, and this allows you to hard code a certain limit to tell the client that, you know what, no matter what you request, I'll give you 5, because I want to protect my server-side resources. Otherwise, I'd have to hydrate data from the database, serialize it, deserialize it, and this could negatively affect my server. So just by setting result limit to 5, I limit the number of records which will be sent to my client. Purely server-side. Now, the client will only get 5 records now and doesn't have to change the logic so far. That's not yet paging, of course. That's just forcing the client to do some paging. So let's go back to our simple customers, load all the records again, and first request always takes a while longer. And now the client will only get these 5 records. If the client searches for a subset, it's okay. There will be only 1 record, that's fine. If there are more hits, the client won't get any more hits. So to implement paging on the client side, what you can do now is you can, of course, implement classical forward next paging. But in my case, in this case, I'll show you just how to implement a more button, Facebook-like paging. And in this case, I'll store the customer query as a page-level variable, as a page-level field, and I'll change the query to skip the number of records which already exist on the client side and take the next 5. This one would be optional, of course, because the server doesn't give us more than 5 anyway. I do not clear the cache. I explicitly don't clear it because I want to take these 5 additional records and add it to our list. If I would clear it, I could do forward, backward, the previous page, next page, paging. In this case, I would clear it so that I only show 1 page. But in this case, if I don't clear it, what I'll get is web-like behavior or Facebook-like behavior when you just get more data whenever you hit more. As soon as there's no more data to be fetched, it will just you'll just only get, let's say, 1 record or 0 records. Okay. What else do you get? Well, if you select a single client, we said that we can update the client, so I could make a change here, call save changes, it will be saved asynchronously, and I just get my message box. If there would have been an error, I would have received the error dialog. Let's say, well, let's just change data here. In this case, let me just reiterate this. What we have in our customer editor is the following. The customer editor is in controls customer editor. And it is codeless, at least as far as I remember. Yep, it's just initialized components. And if we look at customer ID, for example, let's go to our customer ID. This is a text box which is bound using regular two-way data binding. So there's no magic behind the scenes. It's just whatever you do in WPF today or whatever you do in regular Silverlight today. However, as soon as I enter data here, you'll see that it's visible on the projector. This record or this field is marked with a red rectangle, a red border instead of the regular border. And if I enter the field, you'll get immediate validation. So you have automatic validation based on the server-side model. Now, in this case, the model is driven from the database, but this does not have to be the case. You can do whatever validation you want based on the new attributes in data annotation, in system.componentModel.data annotation. There are a number of attributes, and in fact, you can create your own attributes to create custom validation. Okay. But by default, you'll get validation like this. You'll get numeric validation. You can do range validation, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so let's change this back, and the field is valid again. So the next thing is, well, let's look at the validation. Now, if you look at validation, what's important to see is that the system generated this dot metadata class for us. Oh, and by the way, there is, at the beginning I mentioned that there is a slide deck to be downloaded. So yes, there is a slide deck. It's just that I tend to not walk through the slide deck, but create a slide deck which is used as a reference slide deck. So you will find all this information inside the slide deck, all these the things which you can do here. It's just that I'd like to present in a more interactive way. Okay, so you have the metadata generated, and that's one of these scary things in .NET 4, especially if you haven't seen it before. Now, what's happening is the following. Let's just assume one thing before I show you this. If you have a class customer somewhere which is generated using Entity Framework, then you'll have a declaration similar to this one, somewhere in the Entity Framework, and there will be properties generated, etc. Now, if you want to apply attributes to customer, you could just apply an attribute on a partial class. Display name, just as an example, foo. So I could apply an attribute on the partial copy, whereas the second partial part is created by Entity Framework. Okay, but what happens if I want to go to, let's see which fields we have. Oh, it doesn't run anymore. There should be a field called contact name, public string contact name, get set. And the question is, what happens if I want to add an attribute to contact name? Maybe I want to specify that this is required. Now, if I want to do this, then if I try to compile this, the compiler is going to give me an error telling me that, hey, there is already a property contact name on this class, so you cannot do this. However, the whole idea of data annotation is to provide additional information about the fields and properties in your classes. So to make this possible, there is a concept called metadata redirection. And to do this, you have to create a second class somewhere. And I usually do it as an inner class. So you have a class customer metadata, which is actually independent of the customer, and you then use an attribute which is called metadata type, and you specify which type should be used to acquire additional metadata for individual fields. Because then you can go ahead and can say, there is a field contact name here. This field here, this property will never be used. This is just a placeholder property, a redirection property, a dummy. In fact, it's so dummy that you could even define it as object, because even the return type doesn't matter. What does matter is that this is simply a place where you can attach additional attributes which should actually affect the contact name field in the real customer. And that's something the system creates automatically for you as a starting point. When you check the create metadata checkbox in the domain service wizard. So what you'll get is you get customer metadata. Let me just move to customer metadata. And there is a partial class customer implementation which has exactly this metadata type attribute on it, and it redirects metadata. It tells you that whenever you use customer, also look at customer metadata. Okay. And what we have here is we have all the fields and we can apply additional attributes. And as you see up here, there are already a few samples of the things you can do to these attributes. So for example, I could say contact name is required. By default, only company name is required and customer ID. And let's say string length is 15, which would disallow me to save any data which I have in my system. But let's just illustrate this. Okay. These attributes are taken from system.componentModel.dataAnnotations. And they are extensible. You can add more to them. And I'll show you in a second how you can add additional validation to this. Okay. And here's my business application. Here are my simple customers. I just, again, do the same thing. Load the whole list. And I click on something. I'll change my contact name. And it tells me you have to specify something less than 15 characters. If I delete this, it tells me that this field is required. These messages are also translatable. Okay. So that's the starting point. You get a number of things. You get regular expressions. You get range, which you can use to define a from to value for doubles or for numbers. And you get things like maximum length. Okay. Now, the next thing is, well, did you notice one thing? I have defined these attributes on my server side. So these attributes are defined on my server side model, and during this magic, the RIA magic, which is just like setting a reference to a web service, but it does a bit more, the part where it generates the context, it will also take these attributes and move them to the client side. If you would now expose the same endpoint as an OData endpoint or as a SOAP endpoint to store customers via SOAP endpoints, the exact same validation would be used on the server side. In fact, even if I'm using the Silverlight client, when I send data to the server side, this validation will be performed before my update method is called on the server side. So we have automatic dual validation. You have client and server side validation. Okay. Now, can you extend this validation? And yes, absolutely. So let's just extend the validation and add a custom validation. And let's just say my demo validation attribute, because this is an attribute, and it derives from validation attribute. Also, this is defined in data annotation. And in validation attribute, you can override is valid. And then is valid, you check your condition. So basically, I'm saying, well, you cannot have an X, the letter X in this name. So basically, we say string is value as string. And we say if this string is null, or if it's not a string, if the string is null, which also means that it's not a string, then we return OK because we only care about strings, then return validation result, of course, dot success, which would be a static property on validation result. Otherwise, check if Strival contains X, and if it does contain an X, if it does not, so we'll make it easy. If it doesn't, actually we could even add this up here. If Strival is null or does not contain an X, we'll return success. Otherwise, we'll return an error message, and the error message is a new validation result, and we say the validation result is validation context. We'll get a validation context here, which tells us which field is just being validated. And we say validation context dot member name cannot contain X. Okay. In theory, you should also specify the member name here again so that the client can match this back to the correct member. But this should be enough for now, I think. Okay. So we can compile this, and we can use this attribute on our server-side class. Let's go back to our metadata, services, metadata, go back to contact name, and now specify that we have our validation running here. And as soon as this is done, we will get an exception, or at least we get actually a compile time error. Well, no, but we just don't get the behavior we want. Okay, so what's happening now? If I'd run this, well, I can't really, because now I've created a server-only validation. And there used to be an error here, but it seems that the latest beta will take this into account. The system checks if this is a server-side-only validation. Why is it server-side-only? Because the code for my demo validation attribute does not exist on the client side. So this validation could not run on the client side. Maybe because you're doing some things which you can only do on the server side, but which you can't do on the client. Now, if you want to do client-side validation, we have to somehow move this code to the client. To do this, you could put it into a library, of course. But the thing is, if you put this code into a library, then this library would have to reference, well, it would have to be a Silverlight-compatible library, of course, and it would have to reference, well, the Silverlight component or the .NET component. Well, you can't really tell because it depends on the environment. So it's not easily possible to do this if you want to have really code which is not just shared as in code, but as in binary. So what RIA introduces is the notion of enhancing the shared code. So it's not just the domain context which will be shared to the client, but you can flag a certain piece of code and have this code be included in the client side as soon as the code is generated behind the scenes. You do this by renaming your class to .shared.cs. Now, is this an architecturally sound pattern? Well, it depends. Because normally what you'd say is, well, otherwise I'd have to copy the code manually because there's just no way that this code could be shared. The same is, by the way, true for metadata extensions, additional metadata extensions which you might implement yourself, or helper methods which you might want to implement yourself. These would not be shared between client or server unless you call them .shared.something. And metadata, of course, will automatically also be shared. Now, if you run code like this, and you'll get, again, client and server-side validation. Do you have to create code like this? No, you don't, but you can. Okay, but that's interesting. What I'm showing you right now is actually one of the problems in which you might run into. What I've done is I've just, let me just close this again. I've just compiled my code. And what's happening is I get an error telling me that the namespace web does not exist in the namespace system. And it opens, if I click on it, it opens the source file. However, this is the client-side copy of the source file. That's why it's locked. You should not change this file. The one you want to change is actually this one. So that's something which you have to get used to. Now, in my case, I'll just close this one. I'll go back to the server side, and I'll remove this reference because I don't need it. If you have code which you might want to share between client and server, but which you want to might to change partially at least, you could do an if Silverlight to run Silverlight code and else to run alternative code. So that's how you could determine if you have client server side code where you want fragments to only run on one side, especially in the validation. If you have additional validation which can only be performed on the server side, you could run it like this. Okay. Now let's compile this and F5 this one. In my case, I don't really need this, so I can just remove the web namespace reference here, which has been implemented or added by default. Okay. So let's start this, and that's where we are. We'll get the following. Okay, I can go to simple customers, load my client again, go to the to one of them, and change the contact. We have removed the range validation length, but as soon as I enter X, oh, we haven't added the attribute yet. Did I? Actually, I did add it. Let's just check this again. It's in my demo. It's on contact name, which would be the one I've changed. Let's just check this. If the value is null or does not contain, this should be OK. Otherwise, I'll return. Let's try one thing. I'll add the overload, which I've mentioned before. This would be a list of string members. And let's just add members.add. Validation context dot member name, and we say the affected members are these, and we want to overload format message. That's the one, and here we just return last message, which would be a string. Let's just cache this, and in here we just set last message equals our message. And here we go. Okay. Let's see. Oh, we don't need to. Now, yeah, it succeeded. Okay. Okay, let's see. This would be the long form. This is the form you should do. I thought that the short form would work as well. Let's just try this. Maybe it was just a cache refresh issue because the other form should have worked as well. Okay, let's try this. And simple customers load. And sometimes I have to clear my browser cache. That's something which, it works now. Okay. So now you get your validation again. Now, I thought that this has become optional in the meantime, so I just wanted to save some time. Obviously, it didn't become unnecessary in the meantime, but you still have to implement this. It will give you the name of the error message again, and you then can translate it, for example, into a different form. Okay, whatever. The result is the same. You get custom validation running on the server side and on the client side. If I create a SOAP client for this service, and if I send a change set over and it would contain an X, the client would receive the same validation information. Okay. And now what I'll do is I'll open a second instance of Visual Studio, and I'll show you the next step, essentially, the view model-based step. And let's just open the other copy of this application. Okay. Now, so the first step would look very much like classical, like even like Windows Forms code. If we go back to our customer page, and let's say this would be in here, Views, Customers. If you look at this, and especially if you look at the code, it's still, Simple Customer, of course, same mistake as before. Everything is directly behind the save handler, etc. So this is code which is not unit testable. This is code which quite likely can't be reused. So if you'd say, well, I want to create a different front end on top of it, you will not be able to reuse any of this code. It will be directly bound to the UI. And that's how the view model came into play. Now, a view model, let me just jump over this a bit. We've seen this. As I said, the slide deck is just reference. A view model is something which you'll use to bind your UI to. if you don't want to bind your UI to directly to your data element, but to bind it to an intermediary layer which contains more than just the data. It does contain the data. It has a reference to your underlying model, but you want to separate the logic from the UI. You totally want to clear out your UI, or at least as much as possible. And if you want to do this, you can use a view model. Now, as soon as you use a view model, let's just ignore this part for now, because there are some parts which are not easily possible in the view model. But if you want to create a view model, what you'll do is you implement a class which is your view model and assign this as the data context for the current form. That's basically the idea behind this. The code here is just something which I need to override and forward it to my model. Everything else is not part of my UI code anymore. Everything else is handled directly inside of my view model. So the question is, how does my view model look like? In general, most view models somehow derive from a base class called iNotifyPropertyChanged. We just need this to communicate between the backend and the UI, the backend in terms of the class and the UI. And after this, the view model contains all the information and all the logic necessary to do all the tasks of your application, to perform all the tasks. So for example, there will be methods like load customers. But it's just a public word load customers, which will use a property called search text, which is also defined on our view model. So our view model has methods and properties, properties like search text, or a property like, selected customer. So all these are just regular properties here, and all these raise change notifications. As soon as you do this, you can get rid of a lot of the code in the UI and move it to a declarative level inside of the SAML file. And let's go back to our customer view in the SAML mode, which should be here, customers, yep. And in SAML, what I have is, and this is the only non-standard thing. Basically, I define a few commands, and these commands are based on the Silverlight framework, Silverlight FX extension, which allow me to associate or to simply say, when this command is triggered, call this method in my view model. It also does automatic can load customers checking, so you can enable and disable this just by having a Boolean property can load customers on your view model. Okay, so we have these commands, and then we bind. So let's look at the data part, at the data grid. How do we get the selected item? Well, on one hand, we say our item source is the property customers, which is also a property of our view model, which returns the current context customers collection or customers are queryable. And the selected item will also be bound to our view model. So now our view model holds the complete state. Up before using a view model or when not using the view model, then your page, your WPF or Silverlight page or control holds the state, and we move the complete state to a distinct unit. It's very lightweight. The code will look pretty much the same, but you now have an isolated piece, and every interaction between UI and view model is explicit. So it's a lot more testable, and it will be more maintainable just because you have to think about crossing this boundary. Okay. What else do we have? If we look at a command like load, or a button like load, it won't have a button click. Instead, it will just have a reference to this command. And that's how the whole thing works. It's totally not magic. If you look at the save command, for example, we have... there is no save on this one because I just copied it over. But even if you use a save command, we would just have another button which references the save command. Okay. The view model would be customer's view model. I just need to find this one. That's not the one. In customer's view model, which would be in model. Here we go. Model. And, we're in the wrong application. That's why. Models, customer view model. Nope. am I the correct one? Customer view model. Oh, there it is anyway. Okay, so we have things like customers as an enumerable, and it just returns context customers, no magic behind the scenes, same binding, etc. Load customers, you have seen this one before. Save customers will do the same thing. It's really basically the same code, it's just in a different place to isolate it more easily. Okay, if you run code like this, then it's just, it's really about isolation of concerns. It's no big deal. If I run this, then the customer form will have very similar functionality and will just work based on this view model. However, there is an addition here. And I'm sure some of you have spotted this one when I went over this SAML file. And that's another addition inside of the RIA framework. I'm not using a customer editor control here. If you look at this one, there is no customer editor control here. So what happens when I select the customer? And let's just give me one. Yep. This is now a different UI for this one. So how is this UI created? And this is created by using a data form. This is now a fully unchanged, a very simple data form. There's no specific customization. The only thing I did, well, actually, we don't even need this one. Let's just remove this, is to add a data form and bind it to selected customer. What does the data form do? Well, data form automatically generates a UI based on the metadata in your data annotation on the back end. Is this the perfect answer for every use case? No, absolutely not. But for a lot of cases, this is a very easy answer, especially if you have to create very simple CRUD forms where you say, well, I need to create lots of forms and I just want to display the data and have the validation, because you get the validation and you get the generated display. To do this, what might be interesting is that there are a number of additional attributes. For example, let me go to the metadata again on the server side. And the metadata would be in services, domain service metadata. Let's go to our customer class. And customer. You can specify the order of fields, for example. By default, fields will be ordered alphabetically. This is more often than not exactly what you want. And you can specify required. You've seen this one before. And you can specify auto-generate field is false if you don't want a field to be generated for this particular part. Okay. So these are the intro features of RIA. You get code copying between client and server, and you'll get these additional features. Okay, and you get the view model basics. You've seen this one. You've seen data form basics. And, well, you can restrict the query on the server side. We've seen this one. We've partially seen this one. What you can do as well is you can go ahead and go to your domain service, to the generated service, and remove the is default attribute to, for example, get a customer query, get customers. And you can add additional parameters. You can say string ID, and you can then return this object context customers where ID is the value. This allows you to restrict the query on the server side. The client can now not remove this restriction. This would, for example, allow you to create multi-tenant applications where you have, let's say, software and service applications where you host the component for multiple users and they should never be able to see each other's data. You could add restrictions like these to your queries, and then everybody would only see his or her own data. Okay, oh, we'll remove this one. And so that's a possibility. Or you can add completely new queries like this one, which just says, well, there's a new query, it returns a single customer, and this customer will be first or default wherever some kind of condition is triggered. All these will be automatically turned into a service method, etc. Okay. let's just look ahead. Well, and then there are things which you need to do from time, well, in mostly all the applications. You want to add combo boxes and similar things, because by default you don't have one-to-many support as of now, as of today, but you might, well, you will need this in basically every real application. So let's just look at this one. I'm just showing you the result first, and then I'll show you how to do this. And here we go. And oh, just as an aside, I'm using Firefox here, so you see, well, that's pretty well known anyway, that it runs in Firefox. All these things also run exactly like they do on the PC, on a Mac, and I've tried this even, and it just works. It looks like your regular applications running on the Mac now. Okay, so I have a query for products. Let me load products. I select the product, and I have a category to select to do one-to-manys. And what we have here is the products page first, the products or products view. And the products view looks like this. There's a product editor control. Again, the rest looks exactly the same. Inside of the product editor, we'll have a combo box. And this is, again, fully done using data binding. There's only one line of real imperative code. The rest is done using data binding. In data binding, I bind the selected value to to category ID of the currently selected product. That's just so that we can display the current value. And then I define, well, a display name and a value path. And these two will be used for the item source to determine which one to display as a value or to show as a string and which one to use as a value. And then I have a binding to categories. And again, this is purely done on the view model. So if we go to our view model, there will be a view model for, oops, on the client side, of course. There will be a view model for products, which should be, actually it should be in models, but it isn't. So maybe it's in pages. Yep. And we have a view model, and there is a property called categories. Again, this just returns context categories. And to populate this, I've changed the constructor of the properties view model, and I'll just call the property, just call this load query, the get categories query, from inside my loading of this view model. And this is enough. Now I get the binding to the combo box, the one to many binding. What else have I done? For products. Products is kind of the next evolving step for our application. In products, I have, and these are also these small bits and pieces which you always have to implement. I have a change detection. The save button is only visible if you actually perform a change. As long as you don't change anything, there is no save button. So I just go ahead, load data again. Save is disabled. As soon as I enter something, save will be enabled. That again, this is done using data binding or using view model binding. To do this, I just have I first have a property or a method called save products, which is again bound using this command binding. I then have a property called can save products, which returns true if there is a current product and if it has changes. And then there is one line of code to hook these things up. And this is, I go to products property changed. Whenever any property of a product changes, I raise a property change event for can save products so that my UI can refresh itself. And that's it. These two lines, can save product and this change, performs the magic of syncing these things. Now, you could say you want to navigate. If you have a supplier screen, for example, and your product would list suppliers, you might want the user to click on to navigate to a different page. Now, I don't have a supplier's view here, so I'm just cheating a bit and I'm navigating back to my customer's view, but I'll just show you how to pass a parameter. So I'll go to products, I click load, and I should get my products in a second or two. And here I have a column supplier. It's just a link which I could click. And if I click this, then you have to first see that we are currently in products. If I click this, I get a redirection, in my case to customers, and I'll pass some whatever string as a query, just as a parameter. And again, this is now made up, of course, but this parameter will be passed here into the text box and the load operation will be triggered. You can imagine, or you have to imagine, that you're now seeing suppliers being loaded, of course. But this would be too long for this session. Now, to do this, you have the navigation service, and you can call navigate, and you pass the new URI. And of course, you can make this dynamic. And on the customer's page, or the customer's view, actually, which would be this one, there is this line of code on navigated to. I'll give this information to my model, and it just checks if our query string contains something. And if the query string contains query, I'll just set the search text to this value which has been passed, and I call load customers. And that's one of the beauties of the view model. I'm doing all these changes in my model, not on the UI. I don't set text box foo.text equals parameter, but I'll set the model parameter. And everything else is synced. And now to make this complete, or to make our application complete, I've added printing as well. Now, I'm not a report designer. I just wanted to show you that printing is possible. That's new in Silverlight 4. If you look at products, there will be a print button. And I think I've been very lazy here. I think I moved this one out of the view model, if I remember correctly. And yeah, shame on me. Now, what print does is one of two things, and that's just the conclusion of today's session. As you know, that you can run Silverlight application out of browser and run them in an elevated context. You might have heard about this. Now, what this means is that you can do things like the following. First, this is if you're not running outside of the browser, this code will run. It prints. It will create a print document, and then you have to implement the print page event. And in the page, you can set the visual, the thing you want to print. And then you can specify if you have more pages. You could say e2.hasmorepages is true, then this event will be triggered again and again. And you can define a visual which you want to render. This can be a regular user control, any user control, or as I'm doing this in my case, I'm just printing the editor. And then you start the print job. However, if you're running this outside of the browser, if the user has installed it on his machine, we'll do the printing differently. Instead of printing directly, we'll go to the Word application. We instantiate Word because you have COM interaction, and we just print using Word. Of course, that's just a fake. It's really just to show you that I can transfer some text over. It's not a real report I'm printing here. Okay, so let me compile and run this. And in fact, I will run this directly from my web server, from my real server. Riatest.local, and because my real server has been configured that it needs authentication information, this is just an IIS website which I've configured to require authentication, and I start the application, I load a product, and let's see, I get a product, and I click print. This is now running inside of the browser. It opens a print dialog. I'll print this into an XPS file, save it on my desktop as test.xps, and it should open the XPS viewer, which might or might not work. I'm sure some of you have had the pleasure of working with the XPS viewer before. In this case, I think we're more on the side of it. Ah, no, actually, it does work. Okay, so we get whatever is rendered in our visual will be printed on the page. Now, this is, of course, a very simple demo. I'm just throwing my editor there. If I install this application, oh, it's already been installed. Let me just remove this one first. If I install it by right-clicking Install Business Application 1 on this machine, in my case, I've done one more thing. In the properties of this project, in the Silverlight properties, in the out-of-browser section, I've checked the box that I want to run with elevated permissions. That's why I'm getting this rather more interesting dialog. And I say I want to install the app. Now, after doing this, I could close Firefox. I can, of course, close this one. And I've installed the application on my desktop. applications don't have to be installed this way. You can also run a setup or an installer or anything. But I can start it locally now as if it were a local application. I still have to log in because otherwise I couldn't call the service. And I go to products, I load one, and I click print. And what's happening now is it outputs information to Word. So you have interaction with your desktop, You have interaction with your printer. So in terms of business applications, you are getting pretty far with Silverlight. And Silverlight gives you an additional benefit that you can run this inside of a browser. So for all these organizations where you don't want or where you can't deploy applications to the network, you can run it in a browser. If you desire additional functionality, you can deploy it to your machine. You can deploy it to the system directly. And then you can run additional code. Both of these functionalities run on Windows and on Mac as of today. Of course, on Mac, I cannot use COM automation because the Mac doesn't support this. But other than this, you are running a single application model which allows you to create somewhat more powerful business applications without resorting to HTML, JavaScript, or any low-level service plumbing. You could use service plumbing. You can access these services using OData, using SOAP, but you don't have to. So, and I hope that in the last 75 minutes, I could give you a brief overview of Silverlight, and I hope that I could take a little bit of power out of the myth that Silverlight is really just for multimedia, flashy applications on the web. Because instead, it allows you to create business applications, very serious applications, using the tools you already know and the tools which you've been using for quite a while. And I'd like to thank you for being here. If you've got any questions, you can come up to me afterwards and I'll try to answer all of them. Thank you very much.